You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 639, Woe and Despair at the Willy Wonka Experience, Paul McCartney, The Eagles and Strange Tales of Memorabilia, Love Triangles in Rock, and Farewell to Richard Lewis. That's all coming up after the move, and I can hear the grass grow.
See the people all in line.
I've been playing Move singles a lot recently. 12 singles released in the UK, and at least 10 are absolute belters.
Very true.
I love this track. Bev Bevan's drumming is just as bonkers as Animal from the Muppets. And they still had the rather startling Ace Kefford on bass at this point.
They all had great names as well, didn't they?
Ace Kefford, isn't that just the best? From 1967, the kings of baroque pop, number five in the UK, The Move, and I Can Hear the Grass Grow.
I've always rather liked The Move. They're the sort of band who, you know, that we occasionally attract vexatious comment from some of our listeners for dismissing certain bands as singles bands.
Oh, yes,
I think you angered some of my associates with your view on The Cure once, I think. But The Move are one of those bands who I keep thinking I must get a hits compilation of theirs or a sort of a best of and check it out, because everything I've heard by them I've liked, but I've never quite dug into them really. So I wonder if I need a primer to kind of set me off.
Imagine being Mr. and Mrs. Bevan and calling your son Beverly. Beverly Bevan.
I was at school with a chap called Matthew Matthews, so it does happen. And then, of course, let's not forget Neville Neville, father of Gary.
Neville's the total winner, isn't he? He's the winner of all time.
Indeed.
Gary Neville's dad, Neville Neville. Yeah. That was singularly lacking in imagination.
In the same way as the Nintendo plumber mascot's full name is Mario.
Oh, is it?
It is, yes.
Welcome along to Parish Council, episode 639. I'm Terence Stackham, and here's a woman who, according to social media, invites Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles round to her house for pizza. It's Juliet Harris.
Indeed, my parents having a clear out of some of their attic quarters, as a result of which much of my life is being pulled down from their loft. And in my correspondence, my childhood correspondence.
Oh, I thought this was last week that you invited them.
Many people thought that. And to be honest, he is still welcome. The invite has not been rescinded. But although one of my ex-colleagues commented rather cruelly, I felt, that my handwriting had not changed, which I thought was rather unfair. I must have been about 6 or 7. This is my juvenile. I think my early correspondence. So eventually, when there is an exhibition of my effects, in the same way as there was with Freddie Mercury recently, when you can walk around the V&A and see everything that I've produced, I'm sure you'll be able to see my very earnest invite to Michelangelo, who I invited him. I noticed how I did not invite him to have a meal cooked by me. I made it clear that my mum cooked the pizzas. So so poor mum, who would have had to have catered for Michelangelo as well as me and my dad. Various people commented, you know, Donatello would have replied instantly, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, hello, everybody.
I was much taken by the story of the Super Bowl streaker.
Indeed, yes.
It's a Florida man called Yuri Andrade.
Inevitably a Florida man. It's always a Florida man. By the way, if you wish to know your Florida fate, a fun game is to Google Florida man and your birth date and see what Florida man, I presume it is the same man, got up to on your birthday, because there is always a Florida man headline for every single day of the year. My Florida man, by the way, the Florida man birthday challenge, it's called. If you Google 1st September, a Florida man was arrested after trying to run to London across the Atlantic Ocean in a homemade vessel resembling a hamster wheel. It does look like a hamster wheel. I'm sorry, Reza Bellucci was not successful. But yes, if you Google your birthday in Florida man, you can find out what your Florida man horoscope is.
Well, our Florida man, Yuri Andrade, he put a bet on the Super Bowl that a spectator would run across the field during the game. He didn't have a ticket, so he then paid $42,000 for a match ticket. And with his bet due to bring in nearly $400,000 if it came off, he ran across the field himself.
I think that's good business. That's a good investment. That's very, you know, a self-made Florida man.
Exactly. Well, he got a $1,000 fine in the process. But, of course, that, you know, small beer compared to his winner.
That's a sunk cost to me. I think so, that's quite good.
A very cheeky, massive profit to be made. But the joy of the story is burst because the bookmakers refused to pay out. Yours.
Oh, no. Honestly, the bookmakers in Spoil Sports shocker, because usually they're such benevolent people, aren't they?
They're almost a charity.
Many fans had, of course, accused Andrade of fabricating his story. There was a debate on the website TMZ, not in itself necessarily always known for accurate reporting, but anyway, I am sorry that these bookmakers did not pull out. I don't understand what the I don't understand, you know, why can't you do it yourself? That is still the thing that is happening, isn't it? The subject of the wager is it going to happen or not?
Well, quite.
It's happened, hasn't it?
I'm on Florida Man's side on this.
Unusually, I find myself aligned with Florida Man as well. He is a day trader, I noticed. What is a day trader? Is it some sort of like stock market person or something, maybe?
Monday to Tuesday, I suppose, but I don't know.
Indeed, I don't know. But we were talking to someone the other day about, you know, that I participate in the world of competitive quizzing.
So. Oh, yes.
Well, there's quite a crossover with the professional gamblers and quizzing, I've discovered recently. Lots of people.
The murky underside of your quizzing world.
Who knew? Who knew? There's also a couple of people that have very successful stimming world groups, which is exciting. Mm. But it would seem, you know, it seems a real pity to me that the Florida man was, you know, not allowed.
Denied I love his riches.
Indeed. According to, and there was a quote as saying, Being rich is living, I like this quote, being rich is living life on your terms, according to your possibilities, not your limitations. So why not do something no one dares to do? I spent $42,000 to live an experience I will never forget and share how hashtag set and forget has changed my life. From Dunkin' Donuts to number one on the news nationwide. Oh, and by the way, that saying that goes, everything that happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Yeah, that is a myth.
Indeed. Well, he's taken it well. We've had much wry amusement over the years with the annual debacles that are Winter Wonderland Fantasias, promising a universe of delight with skating rinks, woodland trails with spectacular lighting, Santa's grotto elves, Christmas cheer beyond your imagination. People pay a fortune and then discover the skating rink, which was 6 foot by 6 foot, has melted. The reindeer are greyhounds with cardboard antlers, and Santa is out the back having a cigarette and swearing at the elves.
Indeed.
We have a new entrant into the field. Step forward, please, Glasgow's Willy Wonka Experience, a £35 a head event that had families from all across Scotland and the north of England last weekend looking forward to what was advertised to be, I quote, a journey filled with wondrous creations and enchanting surprises at every turn where dreams come to life. Jules, it didn't quite turn out that way.
I mean, regrettably not. As you say, it was rather worse than all of those Kent-based Laplands. this did not go very well. I'm enjoying some of the headline summaries on this, which perhaps say more than we ever could. Your Mail Online, parent fury after, quote, immersive, unquote, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory event turned out to be a tiny bouncy castle, small lollipop and single Oompa Loompa. Actually, that's not entirely true. There were two Oompa Loompas, because there was a photograph of these two women dressed up as Oompa Loompas, both looking like they would rather be anywhere else. But although, having said this, I think there's much to be said. All of the parents involved in children say that all the actors genuinely did give it their all. The poor chap that was one of the three Willy Wonkas that was present broke his silence on the disastrous Willy Wonka experiment. Comedian actor Paul Connell played the beloved Roald Dahl character at a family event in Glasgow. But get this, Terence, the celebration of sweets soon turn sour. Thank you, the Independent, for that quality copywriting, who, bless him, was given, this poor man was given a 15-page script that had been written by AI that had audience reactions of wonder written into it. Unfortunately, it did not happen. Much of the publicity had been created by AI. The real villain of this piece is a chap called Billy Cool, who was the Willy's Chocolate Experience organizer, apologized for his vision of the artistic rendition of a well-known book that didn't come to fruition. 850 people given their money back to Terence, having paid £35 a ticket each. The thing looks like an aircraft hangar with some things in it, which it very much seems to be. There's some wonderful quotes from this. There was supposed to be a chocolate fountain somewhere, but I never saw it. I mean, I feel, in a way, the episode of The Simpsons where Bart wins an elephant from the radio station, a competition that's the joke prize, and insists on wanting the elephant. And is not a, they don't have one, and it can be heard on air shouting outside the station, "Where is my elephant? Where's my elephant?" And Kent Brockman, the newsreader, looks at the screen and intones, "And in a way, aren't we all asking, every single one of us, where is my elephant?" So indeed, where is my chocolate fountain, Sir Terence? That's what I want. I didn't even go to this. It did not go well, by the sound of it. Although I love the fact they sacked everyone down. So the depressed-looking Oompa Loompa woman has since been found and has appeared on Good Morning Britain, I think, and also on various radio outlets. Mr. Connell, Willy Wonka says, I could just read you all of this, Sati, because it is so entertaining. The script was 15 pages of AI-generated gibberish of me just monologuing these mad things. The bit that got me was where I had to say there is a man. We don't know his name. We know him as the Unknown. This Unknown is an evil chocolate maker who lives in the walls. It was terrifying for the kids. Is he an evil man who makes chocolate, or is the chocolate itself evil? They even misspelt my contract. contract, but I do have a legally binding contract, which is how that was spelled, apparently. So, they said it would make sense when he turned up and saw all the tech. It did not. At the end of his monologue, he was supposed to suck up the unknown man with a vacuum cleaner. I asked them if they had a vacuum cleaner, and they said, yeah, we haven't really got there yet, so just improvise.
Oh, God almighty. I mean, taking as read our empathy for the families who shelled out this £35 a person, but a little research into the fellow that organised this fiasco might have saved them their angst and their cash. Because, yes, you refer to him, Billy Cool, fantastic name. On Instagram, he describes himself as Billy Craft's captivating mysteries and gripping conspiracies. But I had a quick look at Company's House and discovered that his company, House of Illuminati, has assets of £1.
Oh, dear. Which, and it's called House of Illuminati as well. That in itself is a bit of a red flag.
It's the perfect recipe in life, isn't it, for disappointment. Huge expectations followed by grim reality. It's absolutely a bit like being a Chelsea supporter, frankly. So,
R.I.P. City.
The Willy Wonka experience, not as good as the Jimi Hendrix experience, obviously. Now joins the parade of woe of all those disastrous Winter Wonderland adventures with their ankle-deep mud, cotton wool snow, and Santa in a plastic shed. it joins the group. This has gone so far worldwide. I happened to be watching Saturday Night Live from America yesterday on Sunday on British television, and the Willy Wonka experience was all over it. There was one of the chief gags of the week, the Willy Wonka experience in Glasgow.
I mean, it goes to show they say that there's no such thing as bad publicity. I'm not sure that maxim holds true here, I must say, although I do wish the Willy Wonka and the Oompa Loompas well. I think they might have done reasonably well out of it.
Coming next, Memorabilia Wars. That's right after Petrov, the Hero.
Increasingly like a trendy young person, Satie, which just goes to show that I'm very much not, because I'm feeling like a trendy young person, which no young person, of course, would say. But I discovered this. It was on an advert on my Instagram fairly recently. It turns out people are now advertising virally paid ads on Instagram. Displayed on something I was looking at and thought, I rather like this. And thankfully, because it was a paid ad, I had the opportunity to click through onto Spotify to listen to it. It's a few years old, it turns out, but I really rather liked this. They don't seem to have very much of a following. On their Instagram, they have 659 followers, which goes to show that to me their targeted advertising must be pretty good, and that they clearly find people that they think they will like that. But yeah, I very much enjoyed this song, and I like every, not very long, short but sweet, but I very much enjoyed everything that I found of theirs on Spotify, so worth investigating. I can't tell you much more about the band other than the fact that I liked that song. But that was Petrov the Hero and Cusico.
New to me, wonderful mixture of West Coast sunshine and a sort of more 2020s edge. Really love it. Their name, I was wondering about their name, and I thought that Petrov is sort of vaguely familiar to me. Wouldn't be to you because you weren't even born. But Petrov the Hero, I thought that rings a bell. Stanislav Petrov, he was a Soviet officer. He actually stopped the world blowing itself up in 1983.
Oh, really? Good.
Yeah, he was Petrov, he was a Soviet officer. He was manning satellite monitoring station in Moscow. And his shift was interrupted with a wail of a siren, an alert that a missile had been fired by the United States and was heading right into the Soviet Union. And it, I understand more sirens sounded. And he was, oh gosh, you know, he knew that his job really was to very, very quickly decide what to do on the satellite monitoring. Did he alert the army and they would like shoot back, but he had this sort of dilemma, and he was thinking, well, his hunch was that it was an error. And the minutes passed and received no missiles of hitting any targets in Russia. And he realized, to his relief, he was right. It turned out the satellites had picked up sunlight reflected on clouds and read them as missiles. So imagine if he had not had that sense of mind to think, whoa, I'll just hold on a minute here. Because if he had alerted his bosses in the Kremlin, kaboom, we wouldn't be speaking to each other now.
Well, that he genuinely was a hero. And you know, now you say that, I have vague recollection. I might have read that at some point, I think. So thank you, Petrov. Thank you, Petrov the Hero, the band. Both heroic in their own ways.
Exactly. I mentioned recently I just finished reading Kenneth Womack's magnificent biography of Beatles and Apple Insider Mal Evans. Although Mal does come out of it rather like a big cuddly teddy bear, there was another troubling side to it all, in that he put the Beatles ahead of everything, including a deep emotional cost to his immediate family, his wife and two children. When Mal and Lily, his wife, became an item, he was working as a trainee engineer of the post office. And, you know, the Beatles were in Hamburg. And then a handful of years later, Mal, on a disgracefully low salary, by the way, is swanning off to Bermuda, America, rest of the world with the Beatles. Lily and the children are living in genuine, actual poverty back in England.
Terrible.
And so, too, we mentioned memorabilia. Here we go. Let's head to 1997, 21 years after Mal died in terrible circumstances in Los Angeles. The Beatles haven't taken care of Lily and the children. And so by 1997, she tried to sell off any little bits and pieces of Beatles stuff that Mal had left behind, including the piece of paper on which Mal wrote down the lyrics to With a Little Help from My Friends as Paul composed it. All of this legitimately at Sotheby's. It was the where she was going to auction it. But look out. Here comes Paul McCartney's lawyers with an injunction saying they wanted the paper and other items back. Paul said, Mrs. Evans does not have the right to ownership of these lyrics. And I mean, I don't know the rights and wrongs of this, but I think this is a very telling quote that Lily Evans gave the BBC show Watchdog at the time. She said, if my husband had remained in the post office, I would have been better looked after. So, Jules, I'm just letting you know, if you have any Beatles memorabilia at all, look out. Paul McCartney's coming for you.
Absolutely. You see, once upon a time, this is semi-relevant here, I think. Once upon a time, many moons ago, I once spent a winter in Roger Daltrey's daughter's coat, which we had come by. A relative of mine that had been given a bag of clothes by the Daltreys, who she lived near in... I want to say Hawkhurst, wherever their fish farm was, it was fairly localish to us. And I ended up spending a winter in what had been Roger Daltrey's daughter's coat. It was a very fine coat. Thank you, Daltrey family, for... They had no idea I had this coat, but it worked very well for me. So you know, it's not implausible that I could own something that once belonged to the McCartneys, I guess, because they're also fairly local. A rather a sad tale, this, I agree. Although, interestingly, unusually, this was 97, and it was a statement that was attributed to Sir Paul McCartney, and makes one wonder sort of if there is more than one side to this story, because it's an unusually angry statement by Paul McCartney, who's usually quite calm in public. And he said the programme is trying to make the Beatles out to be widow beaters. Nothing could be further from the truth. I would like to meet Mrs. Evans and discuss this and come to some arrangement to see that she's taken care of and that the lyrics are returned, to show how ridiculous the market has become, he says, the memorabilia market has become. How ridiculous this whole memorabilia market has become. There is someone in the US who owns my birth certificate. Oh, how people can feel that is right is beyond my comprehension.
He said,
I'm surprised that Watchdog is doing this report. I thought Watchdog was normally on the side of the people who have been ripped off, not on the side of people who are doing the ripping off. He says, I don't wish to cause any trouble for Mrs. Evans or for her children, whom I remember fondly, but I do feel strongly that this original manuscript should be returned to their rightful owners. Jeff Baker, his spokesman at the time, said that he had twice offered to help Mrs. Evans as she was in hardship, but she had not taken him up on it. He was prepared to make her a substantial personal donation. Maybe not as bad as it seemed after all. But I sort of see everyone's side in this, in that they should have looked after Mel better. They should have looked after Mel's family better. Though apparently they did give her £5,000 when he died, which at the time was quite a lot of money, I think, in 1971. But I think that I can actually see, Paul McCartney's point here, actually, that if something belongs to somebody else, I'm not sure if you should sell it. Having said that, though, A, did you miss it before you realised somebody else had it? And B, yes, it's all very well saying, we want to support such and such. How would you have been willing to support so and so if they'd not shown you up? Public, possibly.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in the bigger picture, and it's one that will grow and grow as years go by, that picture related to pop star memorabilia, it's proving both a cash cow and a legal nightmare for heritage acts.
Exactly.
Because people with some with more cash than sense, perhaps, want any little scrap of a souvenir of their heroes. And currently, we have Don Henley of the Eagles in a trial at the New York Supreme Court in a situation quite similar to Lily Evans, but with added complications. And to simplify it, a bunch of blokes own about 100 pages in a pad of handwritten lyrics by Don Henley, including those to Hotel California, New Kid in Town, Life in the Fast Lane, so on. Now, without commenting on the actual case, Jules, which is ongoing, this sort of provokes the question of who ultimately owns physical items and the additional question of how they were obtained. If you bought a mug that the Beatles used during the making of Get Back, or you came across an Eagles gold disc at a car boot sale, again, you might find Paul McCartney or Don Henley at your front door demanding them back.
Absolutely. So the lyrics to Hotel California and other classic Eagles songs should never have ended up at auction. Don Henley telling a court on Wednesday. So he says, quote, I always knew those lyrics were my property. I never gifted them or gave them to anybody to keep or sell. So he was giving testimony as a child of three collectible experts charged with a scheme to peddle roughly 100 pages of handwritten lyrics. People on trial, prosecutors saying that the three circulated bogus stories about the document's ownership history in order to try and sell them and parry Henley's demands for them. They apparently acquired these documents through a writer that worked on a never published Eagles biography decades ago. The case is centering on how apparently they were written on legal pads, apparently, these lyrics.
I like ironically.
I like, indeed, how apt it turned out. I like the fact that a lot of lyrics are often written on on a sort of note, hotel note paper, a couple of the sort of reprinted PJ Harvey lyric sheets that I have signed. One of them has appeared to have been written on hotel paper from America somewhere. A friend of mine bought me a notepad purporting to be from the Bates Motel once, which I used to write notes on occasionally. So I do rather like legal packs. If anyone's struggling to know what to get me for next Christmas and wants to go shopping now, please do buy me chintzy pads. I like those. But the defence is arguing that Henley gave the lyrics drafts to the writers, Ed Sanders. Don Henley says he invited Sanders to review the pages of research, but the writer was obligated to relinquish them. However, again, my question is, did you really, I mean, I suppose the question is it one of ownership or is it one of, did you really need these things? My view is, did you notice these were missing or did you value them until someone else tried to sell them, really? And I don't know. I'm finding it hard to decide how I feel about this. Bearing in mind how much money the Eagles have made already, part of me is thinking, is this just greed? And but then the other half of me thinks, well, I suppose they did write that, didn't they? And that is their property. So it's difficult. You could argue that everybody has a set of lyrics to the Eagles that has got the album because they're printed on the sleeve. So I don't quite know. I mean, does that mean I have to give my album back? I don't know. I'm very confused by this, Sir Terence. What do I think about this? I don't really know.
You know what a lot of people do nowadays, and you may be one of them, Jules.
So,
at smaller venues, people like to grab a band's set list from the
floor. Yes, I've got a Delgado's one, I think, from years ago, and I've got a when I saw Eleanor Friedberger from the Fiery Furnaces on my birthday, my friend very kindly nabbed the set list for me, which is very nice. I've still got somewhere.
Same here. I've got, you know, Clash, I think Soft Boys set list through these various people. I just think, you know, if you're a little band then, you know, we've seen these at a tiny venue grab the set list. If they break through to the big time and become like the next Coldplay, they might come back and sue us all for the return of their set list.
Seems a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? I've got a lovely Egg set list from when I DJed for them and I was stood next to the sound desk man and he had one and they had one and I asked the sound man if I could have his set list and he gave it to him. What's so great about it is people that are familiar with the Lovely Eggs, the way they write their album, their song titles out on their albums, they write them with alternate in capital and then lowercase letters, and the set list had been written in exactly the same style and they had taken the time to do two of those set lists, and I do have somewhere, I don't know where it is, somewhere in my house, a Lovely Egg set list that's written to the thing, and I just admired the fact that they bothered to go to the you know, they wrote a set list for someone else, for sound man to read and then for me to end up with. And Lovely Eggs, if you're listening and you want it back, I'll try and find it, but yeah, I rather like that. But yeah, I can understand why people get frustrated when, like, sort of the autograph market and, you know, the people selling autographs for huge amounts of money and that sort of thing. I can understand why that's a little bit scalpy. But it's hard. I mean, also, are they original lyrics or are they drafts of lyrics? And also, is there intellectual property in a scrawl on a piece of paper? You know, or is there intellectual property on someone ripping off someone else's lyrics? I suspect the latter is more of a case to sue for me, really. It does seem a bit odd that there are these huge court cases over someone having written some words down on a piece of paper.
Well, absolutely. It's also one of these stories, like we were saying before, where you can sort of empathize with both parties, really. You know, if you've come across this sort of thing, what you think is legitimately, and you're a big fan of whoever, a band, Don Henley, the Eagles, Paul McCartney, whoever, you know, the Clash or whoever, I've got sympathy with that, but then I've also got sympathy with the bands who think, well, that belonged to me, nobody gave you the permission to go wandering off with
true.
You know, when it's gone through five sets of hands as well, it's terribly difficult.
I agree.
There's more to come. Still more to come. Love triangles in rock music. And also a very fond farewell to Richard Lewis from Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's right after Prefab Sprout.
Maybe other streets are wider than these narrow streets I know. Still you'll find here ties that bind here where the heart is. Maybe other lights are brighter than these streetlights row by row. All I know is this is home, it's where the heart is. Maybe other grass is greener, and what if it is? I belong here, right or wrong, here's where the heart is.
Taking as read my usual speech about how this band would have been 10 times more successful had they not chosen such an absurd name. This track tends to be forgotten when their best of and greatest hits are considered. Actually written as a theme song for a very successful TV series from 1997, ran to 2006, reaching number 151 in the UK singles chart in 2000, Prefab Sprout and Where the Heart Is.
Yes, the theme to the TV, the ITV medical drama of the same name that was set, had Sarah Lancashire in it, I believe, and Pam Ferris. They were nurses. I used to watch that as a sort of a preteen. I think I probably would have been at the time. Yes, that's a rather sweet song.
As we know, I've been around for a while and experienced a lot in life, particularly when it comes to matters of the heart.
Indeed.
But I don't think it's a matter of regret that I've never been involved in a love triangle. Could be an oversight on my part. But in particular, I've never had two women pining for my attention at the same time.
You might not have noticed, Eddie. Well, you're a busy man. You're always doing things.
True. Yeah, there could be hundreds of them out there.
Do write in if you are one of them.
Yes, if you're pining, do let me know. We have a link to memorabilia again here, as this topic arise before us due to Patty Boyd announcing that she's to send to auction the letters from her relationship with Eric Clapton and George Harrison, and she says she still finds them heartbreaking to read. Incidentally, I don't know if Patty Boyd is financially troubled, but if so, I wonder if Eric Clapton might have stepped in with a donation to prevent these letters going elsewhere.
Indeed.
Anyway, the letters and other items are being sold at Christie's auction house later this month. Clapton's letters to Patty Boyd, by the way, in immaculate handwriting, and I'm going to quote a line from one of them that's been previewed on the Christie's website. Eric to Patty: to cage a wild animal is a sin, to tame him is divine, my love is yours. Right, that's Eric to Patty in 1970.
Sweet.
Yes, one of the most famous love triangles in pop history, but there's plenty of love triangles from which to choose, Jules.
Yes, there's been quite a few, and particularly in those crazy days of the 1960s and 70s as well. That seemed to be the peak era for the pop love triangle. Like you say, George Harrison, Patty Boyd and Eric Clapton, probably the most famous. Layla, of course, memory being written about her. I like this Telegraph article describing the as they put it, the mind-boggling tangle of relationships within Fleetwood Mac the recording of the Rumours album in the mid-70s resembled less of a love triangle and more of a love hexagon, which I quite like as a concept. So going to the studio's banner and mess. Patty Boyd's sister inevitably pops up in another love triangle as well. Jenny Boyd was the wife of Mick Fleetwood. They separated after he discovered she'd been having an affair with his friend and touring band member Bob Weston. At the same time, Chrissy McVie and her husband John, who played bass, were divorcing after 8 years, and the romantic relationship between Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks had collapsed. Christine then started an affair with the lighting director, who was called somewhat improbably Curry Grant rather than Cary Grant. And then in February 1977, Stevie Nicks got together with Mick Fleetwood. So lots happening there, I think, in Fleetwood Mac. You need a sort of one of those diagrams that you draw on the wall with, like, the strings that link everything up, that they're having crime dramas for that. Graham Nash, Joni Mitchell and David Crosby, your pals, they had a bit of a love triangle going on. People from my era as well. My era's love triangle was Brett Anderson, Justine Frischman and Damon Albarn. Justine Frischman leaving Brett Anderson for Damon Albarn, and it was apparently that really did get Suede going, really, because Justine Frischman had been in Suede before they split up as well. And one that I didn't realise, I hadn't quite got my brain around, I hadn't realised that Courtney Love had been with Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins before she got together.
No, I didn't know that.
I did not know that. They had a long-distance relationship because of their touring commitments. Corgan would write her love letters. Courtney Love was enthralled by those letters, but then became so enthralled that she dumped him for Kurt Cobain. Apparently they stayed friends, actually, and after Kurt Cobain had died, Billy Corgan had co-written 5 tracks on Celebrity Skin, Hole's big comeback album in 1998, but apparently they then fell out again. There was a rather eye-watering Twitter spat in 2010 where Corgan told Courtney Love to go somewhere nice and live off Kurt Cobain's money, which was not ideal, really. There seemed to be he wrote some songs for a Courtney Love solo album that he then tried to claw back, apparently. I assume that was for America's Sweetheart in 2004, which is very underrated, by the way. I would recommend that as a sidebar. But yes, I and perhaps hilariously at the end of this, having gone past, you know, Brian Jones, Anita Pallenberg and Keith Richards, you know, these incredible love triangles, the last of the 10, which I might not have put in, but who am I to say, Sir T, is Justin Bieber, Selena Gomez and Miley Cyrus. So we've done quite so much for the youth, I presume, that was sewn in at the end. But yes, there was a bit of a... there was a... Also, why do people play their relationships out in public so much, Sir T? The Insta generation. So Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez, originally kept under wraps, and they went public. And by public, we mean that in 2011, Justin Bieber rented out the Staples Center in Los Angeles for a date night with Selena Gomez. Oh, the pair enjoyed a candlelit dinner in the middle before watching a private screening of Titanic. I cannot think of any date I would want to go on less than that. Doesn't sound good to me.
One thing I noticed from reading this article in the Telegraph this week about love triangles, in all of the 10 situations highlighted, at least one person is left heartbroken and traumatized. Yeah. Sometimes two people, sometimes all three. And,
sometimes everybody. Or the love hexagon in Fleetwood Mac. I think lots of people came out.
Indeed. I mean, well, we know that the Fleetwood Mac rumour situation still has repercussions to this day, nearly 50 years on. But, there was even more to it. I mean, you gave us a very good summary. But, of course, Mick Fleetwood married... Jenny Boyd twice and divorced. They got divorced twice. They got married in 1970, divorced in 76, as you say, because of him and Stevie Nicks and her and the guitar player. But then they got remarried a year later in 1977, got divorced a year later in 1978.
I don't know how people have A, the money and B, the time to do this, Sophie. That's crazy.
As a world-renowned agony uncle, my advice is to steer clear of love triangles.
Because I think so,
sometimes there's just much to be said for a quiet life.
I think so. I don't... People, you know, say... We talked the other day, someone was talking about people having affairs, and it's like, I couldn't keep up. I couldn't remember what I'd said to who about I was. I can barely keep up with one person, never mind more than one. The constant panic. I think the best ever description and depiction of the stress of adultery I've ever seen was in the film Sliding Doors, where I don't know if you've ever seen that, Sir T.
Yes, indeed.
Where Gwyneth Paltrow's cheating partner keeps having to meet up with his friend in the pub in in the timeline where she doesn't catch him out initially. They keep meeting up and it gets worse and worse and worse. And the bloke just sits and laughs at him every single time in the pub as his life becomes more disastrous. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't live like that. Just what is the point? How is that joyful?
It gave me great anxiety watching that film for that reason. I thought, well, if I pictured myself in such a situation, well, I wouldn't know what to do.
I'd last about 30 seconds for either calling somebody the wrong name
or saying,
oh, I've already told you this story. No, I wouldn't have done it. Just it's a no from me, Clive.
I would blurt something out. I'd say, well, you know, we were in Dorking last week.
No, we weren't.
It was with somebody. No, it wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't with you. That was with...
Oh my God. Exactly.
Even aside from the moral vacuumness of it, which of course is the main reason. I'm just too chaotic, Satie. I could not keep up.
Same here. One of the many wonderful points about Curb Your Enthusiasm is the brilliant casting and that Larry David is happy to encourage great actors to shot, often at his expense.
Yeah, scene stealing. He's very encouraging of other people stealing scenes, which says a lot about him, I think, all of it did.
Of course, Susie Essman, Susie Green. And, of course, one of my favourites, the late Bob Einstein as the superb character Marty Funkhauser. But this week, with great sadness, we lost Richard Lewis, who played an even more exaggerated version of himself with great style and humour. He was born in the same hospital as Larry David, three days apart, and continued a friendship through stand-up gigs in New York in the 1970s. Richard Lewis added a terrific sense of the absurd to Curb, and you can see throughout how much fun he and Larry had in their scenes. I still laugh. Anytime I remember the physical fight between Larry and Richard Lewis in the doorway of a jewellery store in Santa Monica, I still burst.
That was great physical comedy.
Dear old Richard Lewis Jules died this week at home, aged 76.
Very sorry and sad to hear this. We, of course, reviewed the latest, the opening of the latest season of Curb recently. As I said to you at the time, this program, I love it and I hate it at the same time because it is it's brilliant. It's such perfectly crafted comedy. And like you say, it's all of the performances that always lift it. And the fact that Lucy Liu appeared as his girlfriend in it, isn't she? The actual Lucy Liu. That was the one where they walked into doors, wasn't it? That was the previous opening. Opening season, I think. I really love, like you say, that everyone being in it. Richard Lewis was fantastic. I think this is such a beautiful quote about him from Larry David as well, saying, I think this is so nice, referencing what, of course, you've just told us. Richard and I were born 3 days apart in the same hospital, and for most of my life, he's been like a brother to me, he said. He had that rare combination of being the funniest person and also the sweetest, but today he made me sob, and for that I'll never forgive him. And you think, oh, that's so sad.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it? So lovely at the same time.
And I love the fact that he was nicknamed the Prince of Pain, so his kind of shtick was his own neurosis, his sort of hypochondria. He said, he describes him as the day car of anxiety. I panic, therefore I am. And actually, for all of us that are day car of anxiety out there, Richard Lewis, something of a hero, it has to be said. He was in all sorts of things. And I always sort of, it's funny how there's not that many. I mean, more so now, I think, perhaps thanks to the success of things like HBO and Sky Atlantic and things like that. But there are so many American sitcoms that I know little to nothing about, despite loving British sitcoms. And I suspect vice versa for fans of American sitcoms as well. There's quite a lot of stuff that doesn't cross the pond, as a result of which you don't quite realise just how much stuff some American actors are in, because there's just loads of them that never really hit big over here. He was in something called Anything But Love, where he was opposite Jamie Lee Curtis from 89 to 92. That's quite a bill, isn't it? I loved his fictionalised version of himself as well. And again, it takes a certain talent to play a fictionalized version of yourself really well, I think. That's why Call My Agent, which we reviewed the British version of that a while ago, was very good, because lots of people playing fictitious versions of themselves in that. Jamie Lee Curtis saying as well, this is such a That's such a lovely photo. He seems to be someone that seems to have, I think if the nicer the tributes that someone inspires, the more likely it are that they're genuine, I think. And Jamie Lee Curtis said he was deep and so freaking funny. He is also the reason I am sober. He helped me. I'm forever grateful for him for that act of grace alone. I think that is so lovely. R.I.P. Richard Lewis, who really did seem to be a lovely chap.
Exactly so. Well, thanks very much for joining us this week. Good to have you there.
I very much echo my learned friend's sentiments as always.
And to play us out, a new old single from an artist we were talking about recently, Jules.
Indeed. I do like to try and, if I don't know what's going on at the time, I like to try and catch up a little bit later on. I discovered this by accident recently on Spotify. I might have known it, but I was reminded of it. They're lovely algorithms. If you like that, you'll like this. I've been listening to the marvellous Bobby Gentry, and as Spotify suggested, I would like this, and I did very much. People largely remember Melanie for Brand New Key, but she did make some other quality songs as well, and I very much enjoyed this actually. And like you say, released as a single following her death, and it didn't trouble the big charts, but it did quite well. Was it the vinyl charts?
The vinyl charts, yeah, to the 20s.
Yes,
26, I think.
I rather like this. This is the late Dean Melanie, and this is People in the Front Row.
I was at her love, and that in my heart, I couldn't quite stop something that I didn't start. Yeah, yeah, the critics said no, I didn't know how it came, so I couldn't go. Oh, ha, 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 ha. Third on the bill of a second-rate show. The audience asked me what, but I didn't know how my predicament grew. But now I got friends, and I think that my friends are you. Yeah, ha, 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 ha. You know, I looked around for faces I'd know. I fell in love with the people in the front row. Oh, how my not for the money, and it's not for the applause, no. Oh, no, no, no. 'Cause after is nothing, it's doing the song. I don't have to hear a thing to know I've been grooved on. These chords that I'm using are usually sad. I had to use them, they're the best chords that I have. Ha, 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 ha. Ah, yeah, this progression is usually sad, but it felt my sorrow when I wanted it to feel me glad.
You've been listening to a Parish Council production.